Chapter 2. Thursday, April 12, 2007, 5:30 p.m. Trevor Kenny, Tree, drove into Bryden Falls Baseball Park after the hour trip from Rivers Bend, south of the border, with three of his teammates, parking his O2 F-150 crew cab away from the diamond to protect his windshield from foul balls. He liked coming to this park. It was usually an easy win. But that's not it. He liked to strike out Christians. Tree hated God. God was someone way up there who got a buzz from watching little earthlings, same as people who like staring at creatures in the zoo. Same as those who follow ambulances hoping to see a good accident, maybe a kid lying injured beside his bike. God is the one who could give a guy a break, but wouldn't. Tree knew people like that. Past the guy broken down on the side of the winter road, wife and kids freezing in the car. No business of mine. No one to coach midget baseball? Gee, that's too bad. God stood by and watched, just watched, Billy and Jesse get gunned down with an AK-47. 1 month before their time in the Marines was up. Billy was engaged to be married. His girl was home making wedding plans. Ended up marrying a jerk. And it got better. Here comes Pete and Greg to the rescue. God must have thought, this is getting good. Are they going to set off that booby trap and blow themselves up? Boom. Gone. Blown to pieces. Better shut up, Tree scolded himself, knowing thoughts like these could set off dreaded flashbacks. Tree got a real bang out of striking out Christians because they loved the one he hated, just like he enjoyed harassing God lovers at work. Being a foreman at the glass plant gave him leverage. If they came in late or made a mistake, they suffered his bias. Call it revenge. He liked to beat the challengers bad, and the Grizzlies he coached always managed. Today would be no exception, though wins were getting a little bit more difficult. The Grizzlies were named after the ferocious grizzly bear occasionally spotted in the region's high up country. They were also called less endearing names behind their backs. They were a rugged bunch, taking pride in their coarse mannerism and appearance. Spike, Tree's assistant coach, was so nicknamed because of his tendency to spike the opposition with his cleats when they dared get in his way. Belch, first baseman, belched noisily whenever he figured the ump made a bad call. Pig was named after the pigs on his rundown pig farm. Or was it because of the beer stains dirtying his rusty red sweater and the beer belly testing his shirt buttons? Most of the team needed a shave and some a bath. It took someone as tough as Tree to manage this horde. The ex-Marine could stare down any one of them. Warm up over, infield practice done, team's batting orders exchanged, time to get to work. Half of the first inning over, the Grizzlies already got two runs off Max pitching. Thought Max said they practiced all winter, Tree was thinking as he approached the mound. Didn't seem to do them much good. Leadoff batter number 33, left fielder Kyle Macklin, the announcer declared on the sound system. Max boy. Don't like this, Tree thought. Mac was his only friend. Yeah, lots of beer buddies, but only one he called friend. I'll go easy on this one. He pitched three times in the same place, right down the middle, fast but not too fast. Sure enough, Kyle connected, a high fly ball into the right fielder's glove. No harm done, Tree said to himself. He glanced over to the challenger's dugout to see if Mac noticed his act of mercy. Second batter, number 8, first baseman and assistant coach, Phil Ferguson. Where does Mac pick up these guys? God keeps sending us baseball players, Tree remembered Mac saying. Well, mercy time over, pal. Tree was exceptionally tall and over the years learned to put all 6'6" to his advantage, using his body as a long sling, often whipping out 85-mile-per-hour pitches, enough to scare most in this league. He expertly mixed fastballs with curves and changeups and sinkers. The fact that he was a lefty gave him a real advantage. Most were used to hitting right-handers. Some had thought he had a good chance at pro ball after the Marines, but serious beer drinking got in the way. The changeup completely fooled Phil, who nervously anticipated a fastball, and all he hit was air. Embarrassed, he would let the next one go by, hoping it would be a ball. It wasn't. Strike two. Tree knew Phil would swing at the next one, hoping to redeem himself, so he threw a ball outside. Phil swung and missed. Have a seat, Pastor Ferguson, Tree muttered to himself. Two out, one to go. Who's the next victim? Third man to bat, number 16, shortstop John Tanner. Ruse boy. I'll show him what it's like to play with the big boys. John's timing was right on, but missed Tree's fastball by a few inches. The sinker never fooled him, and John let it fall to the ground. Tree purposely pitched outside, thinking the boy would chase it. John let it go. A strike and two balls. This kid's smart. How about a fastball just above the knees? John fouled it, two balls and two strikes. John took a chance letting the next ball go by, thinking his opponent would throw one just outside the strike zone. And he was right. A full count. It's hard hitting a ball when you don't know if it's going to come real fast or real slow. Pitcher and batter are trying to outwit each other. Experience was on Tree's side. He could read John's expectation better than John could read the pitcher's intention. The changeup fooled John, and he swung and missed, the ball landing in the dirt at his feet. Fortunately, the catcher missed the ball as it bounced crazily away from his awaiting glove, and John, allowed to run because the pitcher missed the third strike ball, made it safe to first base. The kid got a break. Next batter, number 21, back catcher, Ruben Rue Tanner. Rue. The Challengers fans always chatted when Rue came to bat. Many times a hit to the outfield or occasionally over the fence won them the game. No one in the league could match his reliability. He was their man and they loved him. Best hitter in the league, Tree reminded himself. Last year hit an incredible .490 average. Tree had faced this worthy opponent many times and was wary. Common sense told Tree that he should purposely walk Rue, figuring he could easily strike out the next batter, putting an end to the inning. Since he didn't intend to let Rue hit, Tree thought it a good opportunity to make a statement. Ruben had an aggravating habit of crowding the plate. Often the umpire would mistakenly call an inside strike a ball simply because it came so close to the batter. Tree wanted to give Rue the message he would not tolerate it this year. He purposely aimed for Rue's wrists, but not so fast that Ruben couldn't avoid the ball. It was his way of saying, "Step back," but Rue held his ground. "Damn," Tree mumbled, "so Rue wants to do battle. Okay, buddy, you're on." Tree threw his hardest pitch just inside the plate. Ruben had to jerk back to avoid the missile. Still, Rue ignored the second warning, stepped up to his original position, his body touching the strike zone. Damn Christians, Tree thought to himself. Tree could not back down now. The next pitch would be straight at Rue's head. Pitcher and hitter understood each other perfectly. Rue knew Tree was telling him to move back, and Tree knew he knew. It was a game within the game, a test of the will. Rue realized Tree would not back down, and he knew his fastball could do serious injury. Mac, watching from the third base coach's box, was fully aware of the battle between his friend and his back catcher. And everyone on both teams and anyone in the stands who had even a little baseball savvy picked up the drama. John watched his dad helplessly from first base. Tree knew that many players on other teams would charge the pitcher's mound in rage if they thought the pitcher would intentionally injure them. And he also knew Max strictly forbade any unsportsmanlike conduct. Roof ended off the fastball with his bare hand. It hurt bad. The umpire called timeout, inspected the injured hand, sent the batter to first base, walked to the pitcher's mound, gave Tree a stern warning, and angrily shouted, "Play ball!" Tree struck the next batter out, ending the inning. Tree felt like a real jerk, hitting someone he knew would not hit back. But he was not going to be bested by a Christian. He threw his glove hard on the bench, hoping his team would think he was mad at the challengers and not himself. He sat in the corner of the dugout and brooded. Any other team would get even, but not these clowns. Tree was thoroughly revolted by their sportsmanship. There was an unwritten rule that Mac, the challenger's pitcher, was to purposely hit the first one up the bat to even the score. But Mac would never do that, and everyone knew it. Tree learned from his pal that the challengers were here as an outreach into the community, to be an influence for God, to set an example of Christian behavior. How disgusting, Tree thought. Should never have let them into the league. They don't belong. They're so different. No swearing, no dirty jokes, no beer after the game. They don't even get mad when they're supposed to. Tree well remembered Mac approaching him about getting into the league. Tuesday, January 7th, 2002, 10 a.m. What? A church team? A Canadian church team? You gotta be kidding. Ain't kidding, my friend. We've got some good ball players and nobody to play. The mountains isolate Bryden Falls from other Canadian cities and towns. Mac could see Tree was not at all impressed, so he said, "So we thought we'd come south of the border. The competition may not be so good, but at least it's much closer." The competition, not so good. Baseball's our sport. We're the best in the world. Hey, you're forgetting, I'm an American too. Half American. Just because I'm a dual citizen doesn't make me half American. Not so sure what it makes you, Tree conceded. And there are a few other Americans at the center who play a pretty good game. Well, I guess I can't refuse my American brothers, or my half-brother. Okay, you're in, but there will be conditions. Conditions?
Yeah, like no what do you call it?
You mean proselytizing.
That's it, none of that stuff. No handing out religious literature. And nothing free. Sell your hamburgers and hot dogs and other junk food just like everybody else.
Is that it?
Tree thought it time to lighten up. Be nice if you people weren't so content. You know, leave your Christian smiles at home. Be miserable like us heathens.
Monday, February the 5th, 1990, 9:30 a.m.
This was the fourth time Jenny stopped to talk to the pair of Jehovah's Witness ladies who always stood under the store awning marked Harvest Time Bakery. Over the months, she was attracted to their smiles and warm good mornings. Were it not for the hurt from her husband's uninterrupted cynicism, she would never have stopped to talk or accepted the literature. Now she was desperate for any solution, even a spiritual one. Jenny believed in God and seemed to occasionally sense his presence. She read their material and returned to the same spot,
baby John Douglas in her arms, again and again, and still again, drawn by their friendly manner and seemingly legitimate concern for her well-being. She accepted their suggestion to bring a ministerial servant for a home visit to further explain their organization and beliefs. The only thing hindering them was the snow. "The first sign is spring," they promised. "Yes, we will be sure to come when your husband is at work." Jenny was sure she allowed plenty of space between herself and the car ahead as she pulled away from the curb and the friendly ladies, and could not understand how she clipped the fender with the front bumper of her pickup. She flushed with embarrassment as she inspected the damage. The tailgate light of the car was smashed. Suddenly, a young lady, slender and smartly dressed, appeared, offering her hand. "My name is Vivian Macklin, and I am pleased to meet you. Is this your car? I am so sorry." And meekly, Jenny shook her hand. "Yes, this is my car, but please don't be upset. I have seen you and the little one. He really is so cute, in Marlin's Marketplace a few times, and really am pleased to meet you. Please, could we go into the coffee shop? There's one in this bakery, and exchange phone numbers or whatever people do when there's an accident?" "Well, yes, I will back up and we, my baby and I, will be right in." When Jenny and baby John entered the bakery, there was a coffee waiting for her. "You do drink coffee?" "Yes, thank you. I'm so sorry about your car. I'll cover the cost of repair and also extra for the trouble. I feel so clumsy. I thought I allowed sufficient space between our vehicles." "You know," Vivian replied, "it's no big deal. My husband has connections. I mean, there are people in our church who can fix the problem. My husband is the pastor, you see. He is always coming to people's rescue and they come to ours. Anyway, let's start all over. My name is Vivian Macklin."
"My name is Jenny Tanner. This is my son, John Douglas. He'll be a year old in a few weeks."
"My twins will be a year old in a couple of months." There was no hint in Vivian Macklin's physique that 7 months ago she was pregnant with two.
"You're the lady with the twins? Now I remember. I saw the pictures in the paper. They're beautiful."
"Kyle and Katie. Terry, that's my husband, looks after them Monday mornings. I appreciate the break."
"Does your husband work in town?"
"My husband owns a plumbing business, a one-man business, Rubens Plumbing."
"Oh, does he own a blue van? It seems to me I've seen that name on a van."
"Yes, that's the one. We moved into town about 3 years ago. We live just north of here in some acreage."
"Ooh, sounds real nice."
"Actually, it is. I noticed you were talking to those ladies outside. Are you a Jehovah's Witness?"
Jenny thought she saw a look of relief when she answered no.
"Reuben and I are both Catholic. Sort of. We were married in a Catholic church, but we aren't really anything. The ladies were kind enough to give me their literature. I guess I'm interested in that sort of thing. They offered to come see me when the snow melts and bring a ministerial servant, whatever that is."
Vivian wisely changed the subject. "Tell me, have you made many friends in Brighton Falls?"
No, we haven't. We don't have neighbors close by. We both left our families after we were married. We spent the first year building our log house, and Reuben's been busy trying to establish himself."
"I would like to offer you our friendship. We also moved to Brighton Falls recently. Perhaps our husbands can meet. Perhaps the four of us could get together."
"I can't speak for my husband, but I accept your offer of friendship. You seem to be a very kind person. I smashed the tailgate light of your car, and you invite me for a coffee."
"I'm a Christian, Jenny. I met Terry in Bible college, and we married soon after. We moved to Brighton Falls because we wanted to be a blessing to the people, to demonstrate the love of Jesus Christ whenever we had opportunity. We started with a Bible study in our home, and now we meet at Brighton Elementary School. Perhaps you and Reuben would like to join us."
"No, Reuben doesn't share my interests. Perhaps a better word would be curiosity in religion. And I don't think he would appreciate me driving the winter roads more than what is necessary."
Perhaps Terry and I could come to visit. Do you have a four-wheel drive? The roads can be scary.
We can borrow one. Like I said, my husband has connections.
They chatted freely for an hour or so, the initial bonding of friendship, and agreed Wednesday morning would be a good time for the Macklins to come to the ranch.
Tell me, Vivian, should I write you a check now to cover the damage or wait to hear from you?
You know, I really don't think it's as serious as it looks.
Terry will look after it. Please just forget about it.
No. Really, let's call it a token of friendship.
Thursday, April 12th, 2007, 6:15 p.m.
Tree sat despondent in the dugout, pulling at his mustache, waiting his turn to bat. Maybe it was a mistake letting these guys in. This was not the first time he thought the thought. Generally, Tree was pleased with his decision to let the challengers in the American Men's League. Every baseball player likes to play before a large crowd, and the challengers always provided one. The Grizzlies drew maybe 40 people for a home game, and that was average for the other teams as well. The challengers drew 250. When playing on the road, they often outnumbered the home team fans, traveling into the States in a rented bus or in vans. Looking into the stands, Tree could see that today, the first game of the season, an April chill in the air, was no exception. With their ticket sales, the challengers brought more money into the league than any other. And Tree had to admit it was more than that. He liked the change of being around people who didn't complain so much, who weren't so critical and unhappy. No, he wouldn't want to be part of that crowd, but it was okay for a couple of hours. Tree realized his hard feelings against God lessened in the company of these people, and he didn't like that. Hate and beer had long ago become his pastime and friends. Mac dampened his hate more than anyone, but he long ago decided Mac's friendship was worth it.
And Rue, what's with that guy? Couldn't he have rushed the mound? At the very least, stared me down.
When it's my turn to bat, he will say, "Hi, Trevor," like nothing happened.
Rue had a dark side, Tree remembered Mac saying.
Would like to have known him then. We could have been buds.
Gotta admit, the boy's got guts. Not many wouldn't back up for me when I wanted them off the plate.
Next batter for the Grizzlies, number 4, pitcher and team coach, Trevor Tree Kenny.
Here we go again, another strikeout, Tree said to himself, walking to the mound. A great pitcher, but by his own admission, lousy at bats. A dismal 220 average. A runner on first base, one out. A hit would be nice.
Hi, Trevor. Rue greeted everyone the same, having memorized names and uniform numbers.
Rue. What else can I say? Tree thought. How you doing, Rue? How's your hand, Rue?
Sorry I was a jerk, Rue.
He really wanted to say, tell me about your dark days, Rue. You know, the days when you were a real jerk like me. How did you get out of it?
Tree was embarrassed facing his friend Mac on the pitcher's mound. Injuring one of his people was like hurting Mac himself, and nothing was gained from it.
Well, it's a man's game, pal.
Being so tall, Tree offered the pitcher a huge strike zone. It was hard to get a walk, and he never did learn to master the bat.
Feel funny up here, Tree said to himself. How do you hit against the guy who saved your life?
And his thoughts involuntarily went back 20 years.
Oh no.
Tree knew he had made a serious mistake, letting his mind wander into forbidden territory, but it was too late. Combined with the conflict he had with Rue and the guilt of purposely injuring one of Mac's people, the thought of Mac saving his life 20 years ago opened the door and in rushed the hated flashbacks.
Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat. Rat-a-tat-tat.
The AK-47 machine guns were all around them. His squad had walked into an ambush. Marines were falling.
Tree, where are you? Tree.
Over here, Mac. I'm hit bad. Right leg, arm and shoulder. A bomb.
The rest of Tree's body was protected by a tree.
Billy and Jesse are down. Can you get to them?
Tree shouted over the deafening madness.
Dead.
Both of them, Mac shouted back.
Billy took a bullet in the neck. Jesse got his guts blown out.
Tree's bulky mustache collected most of the sweat pouring from his forehead and face. Staring stupidly at the pitcher's mound, Tree backed out of the batter's box. He banged his cleats with his baseball bat, as if to clear them of mud. He retied his shoes.
Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat.
Play ball.
The plate ump was getting impatient.
Hang on, Tree, I'm coming.
No, don't, there's too many. Pete and Greg are blown to pieces.
A booby trap,
same one that got me.
Run for it, Mac.
See you in hell.
Ball one.
Mac could see his friend was in trouble and took his time, rubbing the baseball in his hands, hoping the flashbacks would soon pass. Rue also knew something was wrong.
Hang in there, big guy, he whispered, signaling for an outside pitch.
Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat.
Leave me, Mac. Run for it.
Not a chance.
The 30-man platoon had walked into an enemy force that was not supposed to be there, waiting for them, spread out in a horseshoe. The first into the horseshoe was Tree and four of his buds, Mac not far behind. Tree's world suddenly went crazy as the enemy opened fire. Hardened Marines fell all around him, screaming like little kids, grenades blowing up the terrain, blood splattering trees and rocks, officers on both sides of the war screaming orders in different languages.
Ball two.
Mac decided not to walk his friend, putting him on first base, but to strike him out and get him to the safety of the dugout. Tree barely noticed the baseball flying over the middle of the plate.
Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat.
The platoon started pulling back, firing their rifles and heaving grenades as they retreated. But Mac, leaving his rifle and ammunition behind, crawled in the opposite direction towards his bud and towards the enemy.
I've got to stop the bleeding. It's going to hurt.
Mac, you're crazy.
Tree was ashamed of his broken voice and the tears of pain streaking his muddied face. They spoke in whispers now, the enemy creeping towards them.
Get out of here, Mac!
Wounds wrapped, bleeding stopped, Mac rolled Tree toward the hollow made by the bomb that killed their friends and shot shrapnel into Tree's body. The cavity was beside a large tree that hugged a muddy riverbank, exposing its roots.
What are you doing, Mac?
I'm gonna bury you.
What?
It's your only chance. If I try carrying you out, we'll both be dead in seconds.
Two balls, two strikes.
Tree backed out of the batter's box again, wiping sweat off his forehead, fighting the demons choking his mind. Rue was trying to read Mac's intention. What was his plan? Catcher and pitcher developed an uncanny communication over the years that went beyond words and signals. They seemed to be able to read each other's mind. Rue deduced Mac wanted to strike Tree out and get him off the field without embarrassment.
Hang in there, big guy. Hang in there, Rue whispered so softly even the umpire behind him couldn't distinguish his words.
But Tree was thousands of miles away, being buried in a smoking pit, with dirt mixed with his friend's blood and body parts. Mac rolled his buddy into the hole in such a way that his head was hidden under the roots, allowing him to breathe, but not be seen. Mac quickly shoveled the bloody dirt with his hands to cover the rest of his body. He could hear enemy soldiers drawing closer.
Now listen to me, Mac whispered. Don't move. They won't see you if you don't move. If you move a muscle, you're a dead man. Don't groan, don't cough, don't sneeze.
Got it. Now get the hell out of here.
I'm not going anywhere, pal.
Got it? I'll be right beside you, hiding in the river. You won't see me or hear me, but I'll be no more than 6 feet away. Quiet now, they're coming. Mac grabbed a pipe that looked like it could be from Pete or Greg's rifle, slid into the murky water of the small river, lay on the river bottom on his back, pulled a heavy rock on his stomach so he wouldn't float to the surface, and used the pipe to breathe air above the water's surface. It was a trick he learned as a kid back home on the farm. He would not surface until dark. Tree laid motionless and silent, face pressed sideways in the dirt. He could still see through the roots with one eye, camouflaged figures emerging from the dense foliage. The hate for the enemy soldiers who mercilessly put an end to the lives of his friends stifled his fear, though they came within a few feet. He wanted to kill them, at least some, but knew he was helpless. Strike three, you're out. To distract everyone's attention, Rue feigned a pickoff of the runner at first base, intentionally throwing the ball high above Phil Ferguson's glove. Everyone watched as the runner rounded second base heading for third, as Phil and the right fielder scrambled for the ball. Only Mac noticed Rue gently taking Tree's bat and directing him to the dugout. The flashbacks withdrew as quickly as they came. Tree would be okay now. He was grimly aware of what Mac and Rue had done for him, saving him public embarrassment, and he felt more the jerk than before. The Grizzlies won again, 8-5. Tree had trouble looking Rue in the eye when the teams lined up to give low fives. Need a beer, he thought to himself. Monday, April 16th, 2007, 9 a.m. Terry Macklin felt at home at Bryden Falls Baseball Park, both when it was crowded with baseball enthusiasts and when near empty, as it now was. Resting in the bleachers after jogging his 10 rounds around the park, he counted his blessings. It was good having the center next to the park, not just because it was convenient, but the greenery it provided. Baseball fields of varying sizes and quality always provided a backdrop for his life, whether shagging balls for his older brothers, playing little league, or serious ball for rep teams. Sitting in the stands, he went over Thursday's loss against the Grizzlies. Perhaps it was too much to hope for an upset against the number one team, but he had to admit he just didn't like losing. Whether it's baseball, or chess with his son Kyle, or Bible trivia with the family, or horseshoes at a church picnic. He often wondered if his severe competitive spirit was a flaw or a strength. His strong will seemed to make him more successful than most. He went over the conflict between Tree and Rue. Tree was in the wrong, but he hurt for his bud nonetheless. Cursed flashbacks. Tree could not escape his past, and his past prevented a tolerable future. He wondered why Rue didn't back up from the plate. Why make an issue out of it? Was that turning the other cheek? Was he just plain stubborn? What would he have done? He knew Rue crowded the plate so he could hit outside pitches. When he connected, the ball usually arced over the first baseman's head and curved towards the foul line away from the right fielder. A runner on second and even first could score. Mac couldn't decide if Ruben did right or wrong by not backing down to an intimidator. Baseball wasn't his priority this morning, however. Mac asked Vivian to direct Rue over here when he showed up for his 9 a.m. appointment, sure that Rue, like himself, would favor sunshine to a stuffy office. Never in all his years as pastor has anyone asked for his pulpit. There were times when a traveling minister, usually one endorsed by his denomination, would make it known that he was available for preaching, and Mac would often accommodate. If Mac closed his pulpit to other ministers, they would close theirs to him. But a layman, he could not remember such an occasion. Yes, he had heard of seasoned laymen being given the pulpit if their spiritual maturity and insights were pronounced. But no one actually asked for the pulpit. It was out of place. Everyone knows the rules, unwritten though they are. Am I possessive or protective? Mac asked himself. He knew he hated to pass the pulpit and the power and influence the pulpit affords to anyone, except those occasions when he was invited to another. But that didn't mean he was possessive, he reasoned. He had a shepherd's heart, and a shepherd protects. Winds of doctrine come and go. They always have, they always will. And they come most often via the pulpit. Mac was disturbed by Rue's inference that God wanted him to speak a word to the congregation. In other words, God wants me to surrender to the pulpit, Mac concluded. Funny, why didn't God tell me? Am I to be intimidated by another man's discernment? Are you saying you received a prophecy? Mac had asked Rue during their last meeting. No. A vision? No. But you seem so sure that God wants you to preach to the assembly. The will of God grows on you, Rue had responded. The awkward conversation over, Mac promised Rue he would give the matter consideration and give him a call. I prefer another appointment rather than a phone call, Rue had replied. Will a week be sufficient? Pushy, Mac said to himself. I thought I was the pastor. A week having passed, Mac could see Rue approaching him from the direction of the church. Rue! Mac! How's your hand? It's sore, but okay. In the mood for walking? I would like that. Hope my BO won't bother you. I've been jogging. I'm a plumber, remember? And they both laughed. Thanks for your kindness to my friend Tree. I know you purposely threw the wild ball to first base to distract everyone's attention. Do you think it worked? Seemed to. Even his team didn't seem to notice Tree's predicament. He would be highly embarrassed if they did. He's been through tough times in the Marines? Real tough. Killing does something to you. And four of our buddies lost their lives in a matter of seconds. Rough. Yeah, rough. Mac decided to get right into it. So I gave your request serious consideration. I knew you would. I decided no. Oh? Please don't take it personal. I won't. May I speak freely without hurting your feelings? Certainly, Mac. I respect you as a person. I've seen spiritual progress over the years. You certainly seem to be morally strong. People speak highly of you. But I must say, I don't really know you. You and I have not been together over the last several years. I don't know why that is. Mac gave Rue a chance to respond. When he didn't, Mac continued. I have strong reservations about opening the pulpit to the congregation. If I opened that door, how could I close it? Surely you could see the chaos that could occur. Others would want equal opportunity. On what basis could I deny them? And there are other reasons. How do I know if you are doctrinally sound? I'm not saying I have reason to believe otherwise. I just don't know. You don't attend Wednesday night Bible studies. If you did, I would know through group discussions what you believe. As pastor of the center, the people look to me for protection. Mac continued. They respect the fact that I am endorsed. You are not endorsed. Not by the denomination, not by the board of elders, not by myself. I'm responsible before God to protect the unity of our church. We're a team, united to do good works. I'm not bragging when I say we do more for this community than all other churches combined. Division among ourselves would seriously diminish the positive effect we have here at Bryden Falls. Many would get hurt. Now please understand, Reuben, I'm not saying I doubt your sincerity or your discernment or your doctrine. I respect and appreciate you and your family. I look forward to many years growing together and working together. And now it was Rue's turn. I likewise ask permission to speak freely. Certainly. I understand your dilemma. No, I want you to understand mine. I say again, I believe the Lord wants me to give a message, an important message to the congregation, His congregation. I searched the New Testament to test what I believe to be a prompting of the Lord, and I find no reason why I should not be heard. I must be obedient. Therefore, I ask that this matter be brought before the Board of Elders. I understand the board is the final authority of the center. Am I correct? Correct. Mac was feeling squeezed and angry and insulted and perplexed. Will you bring this matter before the Board of Elders at the next meeting? Yes. The next meeting is Wednesday in 2 days. I will let you know of their decision. I'll make another appointment soon after that. Okay. Mac had trouble maintaining his cool. It was not okay like everything is okay, but more like okay if that's the way you really want it. I'll walk you to the parking lot. I'm going that way anyhow. Time to hit the shower. Mac was angry. Trouble can do that when helpless to dodge it. Wednesday, December 23rd, 1983, 3 p.m. Terry Macklin walked abruptly through the door marked G.F. Bennett, Doctor of Psychiatry, not bothering to close the door behind him. I'm here to see the shrink, he said to the middle-aged, overweight receptionist. Do you have an appointment? Yes. Name, please. General Terry Macklin. Yes, Corporal Terry Macklin. Unfortunately, Dr. Bennett is away for a few days, a family matter. I could reschedule you, or you may see his temporary replacement, Joshua Morgan. Not Dr. Morgan? The guy's not even a shrink. Actually, it's Reverend Morgan. He is a licensed counselor. I need a doctor to sign a release form. I won't get out of the Marines until I get a signature. Joshua Morgan can sign it for you. Well, bring him on. He'll be a few minutes. Please have a chair. My appointment is for 3 p.m. It is now 3 p.m., Terry said, pulling a chair immediately in front of the receptionist, straddling the chair turned backwards, leaning his crossed arms on the backrest. She was not intimidated. Anger was not uncommon in this office, nor distress and hate and sarcasm. I know you've been through a lot, young man. You don't know half of it, lady. Macklin was annoyed at the receptionist because she was there. Soon his family back in the States would take her place. Friends would taste his sarcasm. The yuck within would not be bound. He would look for an argument and never back down from anyone. Life lost its value. He was less than half. He had seen too much. Joshua Morgan. The voice had a southern drawl. Head lots of gray. Face unusually kind. Handshake surprisingly strong for a man who seemed to top 70. Please call me Josh. Reverend Josh. How good to meet you. I've been looking forward to this for, and he looked at his watch, yes, for 3 minutes now. Come into my office, please. Sign these papers and I'll be out of here, Rev. You're not a shrink. I don't feel in need of counseling, and I know you must be a busy man. Looking over the papers, Joshua Morgan replied, yes, I am authorized to sign these papers, and I will as soon as you tell me your story. My story? Yes, Terry. That's all you have to do. Tell me your story, and I'll sign your papers. Deal? Deal. Coffee? Cream or sugar? I'm a Marine. Black it is. Now start from the beginning, Josh said, reading his file through thick lens glasses. You're 17 years of age. A clean-cut kid with a decent brain, at home on the farm. Sounds like a dream. Then you got thoughts of joining the Marines. Now you take over. Okay, I'll make it quick. No, please. Take your time. I really want to hear your story." Terry saw in the old man something more than indifferent professionalism. Was it interest? Could it be compassion? He felt safe and began to talk about the duty he felt to do a stint in the armed forces before enjoying privileged adulthood in America. About the pride of being a Marine just like two of his brothers. About the friendships he made, Tree and Billy and Jesse and half a dozen others. About being on the wrong ship at the wrong place at the wrong time and fighting insurgents on the tiny island of Grenada in the Caribbean. About the panic and anguish in a teenage rebel fighter stunned by his sniper bullet. About his friend shot in the neck, disbelieving eyes staring into nothingness, and another lying dead, inner parts hanging out where his belly used to be. About his closest friend wounded and in serious pain, who he buried to hide from enemy soldiers. About the hate he felt for an enemy so heartless, and love for friends equally so. It says here you refused a medal for unusual bravery. I refused to take a medal for saving a friend. I thought it would be an insult to the both of us. "Want to tell me about it?" Josh asked while signing Macklin's release papers. Tree took shrapnel in the leg, arm, and shoulder. Tree's my closest friend. We're from the same town, Rivers Bend, just south of the Canadian border. A booby trap set off a bomb. The bomb killed Pete and Greg immediately and wounded Tree, who was 20 feet away, protected partly by a tree. The platoon started to pull back. I left my weapons, crawled to Tree, stopped the bleeding best I could, and buried him in the cavity made by the bomb. I tucked Tree's head under the roots of a tree in such a way that he could breathe, but not be seen. I hid submerged in a narrow river just a few feet away, breathing through a pipe. I came up when it was dark to find a dog sniffing where Tree was buried, growling like something was wrong. The dog couldn't smell me because I was covered in river mud. When he came close, I grabbed the dog by the hind leg and yanked him into the water, drowning him under the weight of my body, and then I remained submerged for a few more hours. Tree told me the sentries heard the dog's surprised yelp and came within inches. They whistled for their dog and went back to their camp, only 50 feet away. Tree was within hearing and able to gather intelligence that would prove useful if we could make it back to our unit. I knew I had to get him out of there or I would lose another friend. So I pulled him upstream a couple of miles under the cover of dark back to our unit. The intelligence proved useful. We got to their ambush site before they did and killed them. I got a few before taking one bad in my left arm. Three nearly escaped, but I went after them, pretending not to hear my sergeant's orders to regroup. The first guy I caught up to was early 20s. After the kill, I never slowed down and was soon exchanging fire with two young teens, yelling at each other in Spanish. Seemed to be brothers. They were too scared to shoot straight and went down easy. The last dropped his gun to his side, hoping for mercy. He looked at my bloody uniform and then into my eyes and knew he wasn't going to get any mercy out of me. My arm's damaged, but I'm not too excited because it's not my pitching arm, and it's my ticket home. I had enough. Yes, you had enough, the Christian counselor agreed. Your papers are signed, and you may go. Or you may listen to an old man's insights. I'm listening, sir. You have seen things no young man should see. You have experienced the nightmare of combat. You have terminated people's lives and wounded others. Unfortunately, survivors such as yourself are usually scarred for life. You'll bring the war home with you, and you will not be able to shake it off for years, perhaps never. Your family and friends have lost the person they knew and will not understand the person you have become. They'll not want to share your grief and wish you would just get over it. You'll make monthly trips to the pharmacist, but your meds will simply make you sleep through your nightmares. In my honest opinion, you have but one hope. I'm listening. And he was, intently. What is that one hope? Jesus Christ. Joshua Morgan was a Southern preacher of many years who interrupted his retirement to volunteer for the Marines as a chaplain and counselor. More than once he was reprimanded for conveying his religious beliefs, and more than once he ignored those reprimands and presented Christ as the only hope to psychologically damaged young men about to return to the United States. He presented the gospel message to Terry Macklin that afternoon, beginning at Genesis, telling of the fall of man through sin, to various Old Testament promises of a Messiah, the coming of that Messiah through the virgin birth as revealed in the Gospels, the payment for man's sin at Calvary, and the promises for all who entrust their lives to Christ. "I've heard all this before," Terry responded, much subdued, "but this is the first time I listened." And I hereby make a decision to believe in, to receive Jesus Christ." "You do?" Joshua was surprised at Terry's pronounced decision. The most he hoped for from a young man so angry and disillusioned was that he would consider the matter of his salvation. In tears that would not be checked, Terry repented of his many sins and embraced the Lordship of Christ. Corporal and counselor hugged each other as the new birth swept over the young man's spirit, and the horrors of war poured out of him in gushes of sobs and loud groans, never to return. Before leaving the old man's office, Terry inquired, "Did you see my friend Tree? He had an appointment yesterday morning." "No, he would have seen Dr. Morgan just before he left to attend to family matters." "Oh." Wednesday, February 28th, 1990, 9:30 a.m. Sitting in front of her canvas on the porch, Jenny was happy to see the familiar white SUV in the distance. "Here they are again," she marveled, watching them wind their way over the slippery makeshift road. "It snowed 5 inches overnight, yet here they are." She expected a phone call from the Macklin saying the roads were too slippery to chance, and could they cancel their Wednesday morning visit this week. But they always came, 4 consecutive Wednesdays now, securing a babysitter and borrowing a 4-wheel drive. Why did they come? Why thoroughly inconvenience themselves to befriend me? She happily turned inside to put the coffee on. Mac loves his coffee, Jenny had learned. Soon the 3 of them were sitting around the living room fireplace, tamarack and pine crackling, hands outstretched to catch the warmth, talking about the ranch. "I see Reuben is about to do some fencing." Mac had noticed a pile of 5-inch pressure-treated posts and 3-inch stringers. "Yes, he figures 6 or 7 Saturdays when the ground thaws in the spring, and he'll have the fencing done." "Is he building a corral?" Mac asked. 3 corrals, actually. We hope to board horses soon. There's a demand for that, we understand." "Reuben must be a hard worker," Vivian said. "He is that." Jenny was wanting, even desperate, to get where they left off after their last visit. Their friendship established, Jenny had poured out her troubles to her new friends 2 Wednesdays back. The first time she spoke of her hurt to anyone, more than a little embarrassed by her intervals of weeping. She trusted them, warmed by the love and respect they showed each other, concluding it was indeed genuine. Vivian once said their love for each other was a natural consequence of their mutual love for Christ. Last Wednesday, Jenny was quite candid with Mac and Vivian. "The Jehovah's Witnesses teach they are God's true spokesman on earth, and the Christian churches are so divided they can't possibly be the people of God they claim to be. I can see for myself several denominations right here in Bryden Falls. Each seems to have its own brand of Christianity. The Jehovah's Witnesses are united. They say this unity gives credibility to their claims. I can see you have been reading their literature, Mac responded. Now let me ask you, what country would you think would be one of the better ones in the world? Canada? Perhaps the U.S.? Do the people seem to be united, or is there diversity? There is much diversity, Jenny answered. Now think of a nation you would least like to live in. Would you say that country is united? Yes, very. And I get your point. If I may carry on, Christ didn't come to establish an organization by which people may be saved. He gave himself. No denomination, no church or religion can save anyone. But Christ will save anyone who puts his or her trust exclusively in him. I don't doubt your sincerity, Jenny responded, but can you understand my confusion? So many people reading the same Bible seem to come to a different conclusion. The Jehovah's Witnesses I talk to seem to be equally sincere. There is a way of knowing the truth, Max said. Anyone? Are you saying anyone can find truth? That's hard to believe. Yes, I believe anyone can find truth. How? Jenny wanted to know. Ask God for truth. You make it sound simple. Why then doesn't everyone ask for truth and be in agreement? Surely everybody wants truth. Jenny was not being argumentative. She really wanted to know. No, that's not so, Mac gently responded. Many want that which they already believe is the truth to be the truth. Truth will bring change, and people are not willing to accept change. If you embrace the truth of Jesus Christ, your life will be changed radically. I want truth. I assure you, if you sincerely, and I emphasize the word sincerely, ask God for truth, he will give it to you. Really? Jenny looked to Vivian for assurance. Try it, Jenny. Vivian responded, her tone always soft and caring. Ask God for the truth about Jesus Christ. We can't say how long God will take to answer your prayer, maybe a day or a week or a month, but answer he will. And so later in the week, after some hesitation, Jenny did just that. She simply asked God for truth. Soon afterwards, thoughts came and insights. For the first time, she could see inside the ladies who gave her the Watchtower literature. Talking to them outside the bakery the following Tuesday, yesterday, she discerned they were as hollow as she was. The Macklins were not hollow. There was life there, undeniable. She recalled scripture verses Mac and Vivian showed her and knew, how did she know, the words were true. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. She was prepared to entirely place her future on these words of Christ. Truth had come, just as the Macklin said it would. But now what? She was so glad last night's heavy snowfall did not deter her friends. And yes, she was happy to be sitting around the fireplace, sipping coffee, nibbling on homemade cookies, making small talk. But her heart was spilling over with a hopeful anticipation she had never before experienced. Mac was telling a funny story about a lady who locked her keys in her car at the church last Sunday when Jenny interrupted, tears streaming down her face. I'm sorry. I don't want to sound rude. I was afraid you wouldn't come because of the heavy snow. I want to do it now. Do what, Jenny? Vivian and Mac both asked. I don't know what. The Holy Spirit was all over her. I did what you said, she blurted out. I asked for truth, and did I get it? I know you are right. About Jesus, I mean. But now I don't know what to do. Ask Jesus to forgive you your sins, Vivian replied. Invite him into your life. Tell Jesus you want to live for him. Tell him. Jenny Tanner was born again of the Holy Spirit that Wednesday morning. Her conversion to Christ went deep. Unlike most Christians, she did not fade into and out of lukewarmness as the years, with their assortment of upsets and distractions, rolled by. Satan acquired a formidable enemy that day. Jenny was a gentle warrior. No longer would she shy away from her husband's ranting. No longer would she entertain thoughts of escaping. She would not fear him. She determined to confront his sarcasm with the peace of Christ that passes all understanding. When he belched his scorn, she would sing praises to her lovely Jesus in her sweet alto voice. Reuben would insist she not attend Bryden Falls Community Christian Center. Jenny would go and invite him to go with her. "Tell Reuben I'll be here when the ground thaws to help him with the fencing," was the last thing Max said just before driving off. "But," was all Jenny got a chance to say. There could be a clash, she wanted to warn Mac. She knew Reuben would be furious to learn of her decision to follow Christ and of the Wednesday morning meetings with the strangers that brought her to this decision. Think I'll bake him his favorite apple pie. Monday, April 16th, 2007, 11:45 a.m. Terry Macklin could not pace his concerns away, but somehow it eased the tension. Pushing the long table in the boardroom against the wall increased his pacing space, and occasionally he stopped in front of one of the windows to stare in the direction of the baseball field. In his mind, he could see himself and Reuben walking around the field, and he went over again their uneasy conversation. Perhaps it would have been best if he said, "Sure, Reuben, no problem," when Rue first requested the pulpit. But now it had become an issue. Now the Board of Elders would have to be involved. Embarrassing. Mac had no doubt the board would back him up. They always did. Yes, they would ask pertinent questions and try to give intelligent input, perhaps even make a suggestion. That's what board members do. But in the end, they would express their confidence in his leadership and leave the final decision to him. Though the leader, Mac actually had less to say than the others. He learned he didn't have to talk much to get what he wanted, because usually everybody wanted the same result. He would give a list of business matters to the elder he appointed to chair the meetings. Seldom were spiritual issues discussed with the elders, and the matter would shoot back and forth over the table. When he approved of what was being said, which was most of the time, he would smile a knowing smile, making eye contact with the speaker. When he disapproved, he would smile the same smile, but look down at the table. In this simple way, he steered, when steering was required, the board to an acceptable conclusion. Of course, this only worked because of the leverage he had as pastor. Mac never asked for leverage. He never worked for it. It came with a job. And he understood it. And his superiors expected him to use it for the betterment of the congregation. Every person at the center, elders included, was reliant upon a favorable standing with the pastor to be successful, socially and functionally. Not one of the elders would be an elder without his endorsement. The same was true with every ministry at the church. Pastor Mac's approval was required, another unwritten stipulation of church life. Organized ministry outside the church insists everyone has the pastor's endorsement. A poor relationship with Pastor Mac would be interpreted by everyone, Pastor Mac included, as having a substandard relationship with God. This all made for very good leverage. Proficient use of leverage is the ability to use it unnoticed. It could be argued that, morally, one should not use leverage at all. Everyone should be on the same level playing field. But it is most tempting to use what you have when the welfare of the church is at stake. A board is to provide checks and balances so that one does not have excessive control over many. Power does corrupt. Not always, but usually. However, the elder is in a tight spot. He wants to, needs to, please the pastor and at the same time hold him accountable. Now an elder is an elder because he likes being an elder. As a layman, it is the highest position he could hope for. It gives him status plus an opportunity to serve God. If he proves to be supportive, he will likely be asked to serve again. His reinstatement is determined most often by the pastor he is supposed to hold accountable. Leverage is against him. Mac has, on occasion, used leverage to weed out those he felt would be detrimental to the church, but only after subtle hints were ignored. Some refused to tithe, and that would be acceptable, barely, if they just kept their mouth shut about it, if they didn't negatively affect others. To protect unity, to protect the financial base, such people must be weeded out. Pastors quickly master the art of giving nonverbal messages to dissenters, letting them know their attendance is no longer welcome. This can be communicated subtly by ignoring those persons or withholding warmth given to others. If these don't work, a disapproving frown no one else sees will probably do the trick. Mac never used the pulpit to weed out undesirables, as some pastors did. The pastor might use the "This church is not for everybody" sermon, proven effective against nonconformists. The bottom line of this message is, if you're not happy here, if you do not agree with the way we do things, perhaps it's time you found another church more to your liking. Faced with the threat of being uprooted from relationships, of having to start all over somewhere else, the dissident could quickly become a conformist, though an injured and disgruntled conformist. Mac knew many, perhaps most, pastors in the denomination would not tolerate anyone challenging their wisdom and authority by appealing to the board. That person would never be made to feel welcome again. But Mac was a scrupulous pastor, mostly. Rarely did he use dirty tricks. True, he was a bit of a controller. He liked to keep everything under control, and it's impossible to control circumstances without controlling people. If he didn't control, he reasoned, chaos would soon invade. It's not easy being untaught. Mac loved the seven elders. Each had a heart to serve. Each was committed to the welfare of the center. Each a faithful tither. Two he bowled with. Others he worked with in various ministries. Everyone he gave a helping hand in one way or another, and they were equally eager to reciprocate. Every time there was a change in eldership, he had a plaque listing the elders, made at his own expense, and hung it in the boardroom. Brent Anderson, Tony Borick, Nelson Chesney, Sean Edwards, Terry Macklin, David Thomas, Sheldon Waters, Donald Williamson. Brent Anderson, owner of a car dealership, financially the most successful in the church. Avid bowler, much nervous energy, overworks. Solid marriage, one son, one daughter. First 2-year term on the board. Tony Borick, carpenter, quiet, deep, nice family, founding member, 5th term on the board. Nelson Chesney, accountant, managed the center's books, wife taken by cancer, 3 young daughters, dating a lady from another church, 1st term. Sean Edwards, salesman for a meat company, soft, wife, a son, and 2 daughters, knowledgeable in scripture, Sunday school director, 3rd term. David Thomas, youngest, perhaps the most spiritual, always going to conventions, servant's heart, Second child on the way. First term. Sheldon Waters, owner of an equipment rental. Chairs meetings. Heart of gold. Not the greatest bowler. Leads worship with wife on piano. Third term. Donald Williamson, oldest but quite healthy. Retired pastor. Past district elder. Outspoken. Second term. Mac had Vivian fax all seven information regarding Rue's request for a board decision, so they would have ample time to consider the matter. Hopefully the issue would be brought to a quick conclusion on Wednesday. Early Saturday morning, March 10th, 1990. Reuben Tanner rose early Saturday morning to get a good start on the fencing of the corrals. It was spring at last, snow mostly gone, ground thawed, time to get to work. Dressed in his plumber's overalls and a sheepskin jacket, he marked out the location of each of the corral posts with short wooden pegs, following his dad's instructions given last night over the phone. His dad had told him to determine the center of the corral, drive a small pipe into the ground at center point, put a noose on the end of a 25-foot rope, and drop the noose over the pipe. Then he was to tie a pointed stick on the other end of the rope, dragging the point of the stick on the ground as he revolved around the pipe to make a perfect 50-foot circle scratched on the surface. Next, he was to mark the circle every 9.5 feet with pegs, the distance required for the 10-foot-long horizontal stringers. Reuben was not surprised the last peg was the desired 4 feet from the first, exactly right for a gate. His dad knew what he was doing. After marking out the three corrals, he marked out the post locations for the fence on each side of the roadway leading away from the house. Altogether, there were 68 posts to be installed, 68 holes to be dug, each 2 feet deep, each with a handheld post hole digger. It was a lot of work. Combined with nailing the stringers, three high between each post, Reuben figured at least 6 full Saturdays, maybe more. After just 4 holes, his arms were starting to weary, the ground being a mixture of soil and small rocks. Off in the distance, he noticed a tractor on his roadway, heading towards him. Who can that be? He wondered. Who do I know who owns a tractor? As the tractor got closer, he was quite happy to see a post hole digger mounted on the back of the tractor. The guy driving the tractor jumped off and said, "Hi, I'm Terry Macklin. My friends call me Mac. Thought you could use a hand." Reuben was quite aware who Terry Macklin was, the guy who got his Jenny hooked on religion. He didn't respond to Mac's greeting, didn't say a word, ignored Mac's outstretched hand. Mac broke the awkward silence by climbing on the tractor, turned it around, backed the spiral blade towards the next peg. Begrudgingly, Reuben waved him back until the blade was in the right spot. Mac engaged the machine, waiting for Reuben to signal when he was deep enough, and then, in just a couple of minutes, he was backing towards the next peg. Being a farm boy, Mac and tractors got along just fine. 3 hours later, 68 holes were dug. Mac shut down the noisy tractor, leaving them both in uncomfortable silence once again. Reuben turned his back on Mac, walking to the pile of 5-inch posts, carrying 2 at a time, lying each near a hole. When the ex-farm boy jumped on the tractor, Reuben thought he got rid of his uninvited visitor. But no, Mac drove to the pile of posts, loading about 30 at a time on the front forks, and drove to where Reuben was standing, watching him. Reuben begrudgingly unloaded the posts as Mac drove beside each hole. It was now 3 in the afternoon. There were 68 holes, each with a post lying nearby, and neither had stopped for a break. Reuben had bottled water but didn't drink, nor did he offer it to his helper. From the log house kitchen, Jenny was watching with apprehension. The table was set for lunch, but Reuben and Mac didn't stop working. About 3 p.m., she considered bringing out coffee and sandwiches, but decided, no, let them be. Mac held the posts in place with Reuben's long level while Reuben filled the hole, tamping the dirt as he did so. This two-man job would have been awkward for Reuben by himself, but because there was two, the posts went in quickly. Mac traded his level for Reuben's shovel after 34 posts to make sure he did his share of the tough labor. 5 o'clock now, and it looked like Reuben had no intention of stopping for supper. Mac drove his tractor to the huge pile of stringers, and together they loaded them on the forks, distributing them between the posts. It was now 6 o'clock. Both were tired. Both were hungry. Neither let on that they were either. Now it was time to nail the horizontal stringers to the upright posts. Reuben's plan was to tie the stringers in place to the posts with wire, nail on the stringers with 6-inch spiral nails, and then remove the wire. Time-consuming. With the extra pair of hands, one held the end of the stringer in place while the other nailed. Much faster. It was hard holding the post while someone was hammering a nail into it, so Mac drove his tractor against the post, and that took care of that problem. It was getting dark, so Reuben brought his pickup close and turned on the headlights. They continued to work into the night, neither uttering a word. Reuben was surprised Mac lasted the day, more surprised he worked through the evening into the night, this without food or water or rest. Reuben was exhausted and would have quit hours ago, but he would not be outworked by a Christian. He didn't know he was competing with a toughened ex-Marine, as strong-willed as himself. It was 10 minutes before midnight when the last nail was hammered in place. Mac climbed on the tractor to leave, and then, impulsively, he jumped off again, walking to Reuben leaning on a fence post. When my wife Vivian and I visited Jenny, I noticed quite a few baseball trophies on the fireplace mantel. No response. Our church has put together a pretty good men's baseball team. We play against other church teams. We could use your help. There is, however, a stipulation. Everyone on the team has to attend Bryden Falls Community Christian Center. No response. I would like you to join our team. I will make an exception in your case. You will only have to attend Sunday service twice a month. No response. Mac turned to leave, hesitated, and then said, "You know, if my wife were attending a church, I'd want to know who the people are and what they stand for." He jumped on the tractor and waved goodbye, avoiding eye contact, knowing the plumber would not wave back. He could not remember being so tired, and it would be another hour before he was home in bed. Reuben's head was blurred from fatigue. His body ached everywhere. Still leaning on the post, he stared at the 3 finished corrals visible in the moonlight and the fence bordering both sides of the roadway, a job that was to take 6 or 7 Saturdays. And then he watched the tractor lights bobbing on his potholed road heading for the highway, trying to figure out the guy that just matched him in a long, strenuous day's labor, a pastor no less. "Son of a bitch," he said incredulously. Thank you.